For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we are talking with individuals whose jobs touch on aspects of LGBTQ life. For this episode, which is the final episode of the season, we spoke with Josh Block. Block is an ACLU attorney, specifically with the ACLU's LGBT and HIV project. He talks to us about how he came to work on that project and leads us through the experience of actually working on one of these cases, the feelings that are associated with it, the kind of complex ways that he has to think about writing legal briefs, even what it's like in some cases to actually argue a case. Then in a Slate Plus Extra, Block talks about some of the LGBT, specifically civil rights struggles that he thinks are going to be coming down the legal pipeline in the next few years. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
I'm Josh Block, and I am a senior staff attorney at the ACLU's LGBT and HIV project.
So what is that project? What sort of legal action are you pursuing through the LGBT and HIV project at the ACLU?
So, you know, the ACLU is a enormous organization dedicated to protecting the civil liberties and constitutional rights of people across a whole range of issues. And I'm privileged to be working in a subgroup within that where we're focused particularly on ensuring the dignity and equal treatment of people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or any other sexual orientation or gender identity, and in addition, people living with HIV.
Cool. How did you end up working on that kind of area of legal activity in the first place?
You know, that's a good question because I definitely knew people in a college or law school that had as their, vision of themselves in the future being professional gays. And I never really, if you asked me, I was going to have to say how many years ago that was.
You don't have to say how many years ago.
I'm a little bit, that's depressing now. But if you asked me back then whether I would be there, I would have said, like, I want to be, a gay professional, not a professional gay, where
the distinction being working not just on gay issues, right?
Yeah, but also have, feeling like you don't want your having a firm distinction between your personal identity and your professional life and not feeling like they were what you were bringing to the table professionally involved your sexual orientation as being a big factor. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are plenty of people, who work in the movement protecting LGBT folks who don't identify as LGBT themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though you can be a professional gay without actually being a gay professional,
Sure. It
turns out.
Professional ally, maybe.
Yes. But what actually happened was I always sort of hoped I'd end up at the ACLU or a similar organization. And you're always told you never know when those spots are going to open up. It's sort of like winning the lottery. And I had, been sort of monitoring the job openings at the ACLU really very closely.
This when you were still in law school, or?
Oh no, this is at after I graduated. I went to a law firm, mm-hmm. Paid off some debts. Mm-hmm. Although the law firm I chose was Jenner and Block, no relation to me, but when I was deciding where to go for my summer associate year, that was. I was making that decision right after Lawrence versus Texas was decided, and Jenner and Block was the law firm that did it. And I, remember interviewing with, Paul Smith and Bill Hohengarten and other folks that were key parts of that team. And that is, a huge reason why I went to that law firm in the first mm-hmm. place. But it's a law firm, and I wanted to do something that I found meaningful 100% of the time instead of just on pro bono cases. Mm-hmm. And then it was the Bush years. There was a hiring freeze after the economy tanked, and I was sort of waiting for the next job opening to come, and I was lucky enough that it was this one. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the job opening, and I realized that I was simply by being a person who was interested in the world of legal LGBT issues, I actually ended up being more knowledgeable and qualified than I sort of would have thought I would be. Mm-hmm. And it sort of it was like a match that, just sort of fell into my lap, and I didn't realize what a great fit it was for me until I had it. But, I could have ended up in the Reproductive Freedom Project just as easily, although I probably would have then ended up moving over to LGBT at some point.
So in some way it was destiny for you between your desires and your expertise.
Destiny or, dumb luck.
Sure. Yeah. So I assume you work today with a large team. ACLU is a large organization. I don't know how large the LGBT and HIV project is, but how many folks do you work with over there?
So it's a really unique organization because there's the national ACLU with national offices, and then we also have ACLU affiliates in all 50 states. And so we're really sort of privileged that when we take on a case in, for example, Virginia, it's, the national team and the team at the ACLU of Virginia, working on the case with us. So mm-hmm. My colleagues at the national office in the LGBT project, they're about, depending on how you count it, I think I should have come prepared with this answer.
I'd
say maybe 8 people, and that includes some people that split their time between that project and a different one. But then, there are people across the country that, that we do the cases with who are generalists, but, they do these cases, as part of the generalist work that they do.
Yeah. So what is your role on the team? I mean, this is where I show my ignorance, but what does an ACLU lawyer actually do on a day-to-day basis?
What we do is we have an impact litigation model, which is, different than many other organizations that have a direct services model. And that has some pros and some really, really, really big drawbacks. And mm-hmm. so the big drawbacks are that, people's lives in a lot of situations don't fit into, what your, perfect legal impact court case.
Can you say what you mean by impact court case?
So, Edie Windsor, for example, who, I was on the team at the Supreme Court that worked on her case. And, she was the plaintiff that took down the Defense of Marriage Act. Mm-hmm. And, she is – you couldn't imagine, a more capable – and inspiring spokesperson mm-hmm. than her. And, you couldn't imagine, you know, in addition, someone more, you know, suited to speak to, you know, even people who have no other familiarity with LGBT folks beforehand. And, you know, I think a lot of the iconic, you know, court cases that you think of, you know, often try to tell this, you know, story that is going to be most compelling for the court and for the public at large in understanding this issue, understanding why it's important, understanding the people who are affected by it. And that also means that you are picking cases and clients that present that issue, you know, the most cleanly. So there aren't like other messy factual questions or things that get in the way of the clean legal story. And so not everyone's lives, you know, fit into that. And sometimes the people who like need help the most are, you know, the people who we have the most difficulty, you know, framing into that sort of model. If you say, I'm going to get you relief, even if in the best case scenario, you say, oh, this is a great issue to take to the Supreme Court. Maybe in, you know, 3 or 4 years, you'll have, you'll have your rights vindicated. You know, if someone is getting evicted from their apartment, that's in a month, you're not always in a good position to help them. So I think that there is an element that we try to be very self-conscious of, is that we're just sort of one small piece of protecting people's dignity and equality and basic welfare, in that it is there's a much broader network of people in legal services organizations, public defenders, people across the board that are much more connected on a day-to-day basis with the community that they're serving. And that's something that I unfortunately don't get to experience as much of. I only get to come in if it looks like we get a request for help or we hear of a situation from someone who would potentially be a plaintiff that would establish a broad legal precedent or tell a broad story that reaches a whole range of people. And that's only, you know, it's rare for someone to fall into that role.
So if I can paraphrase, impact is literally about thinking about the larger legal impact that a case might have down the road?
Yeah. So it's, you know, the model, which again has its weaknesses, but the model is finding cases that establish big precedents that then change the law and have a far-reaching effect on people's lives. And so, taking down DOMA, establishing a national freedom to marry, establishing that civil rights laws that protect against sex discrimination include protections for LGBT folks, including Gavin Graham, striking down President Trump's ban on trans people being allowed to serve in the military. And I think that, you know, establishing, you know, winning Windsor, winning Obergefell, establishing those rights actually do have an incredible ripple effect in the daily lives of people. So at least that's the plan or the hope.
And it does certainly seem to be true here. Well, and hopefully we can talk more about those cases in a minute. But I mean, you know, not every day is a day, I assume, where you feel that you're shaping world historical or at least national experience and life and changing the law. I mean, surely there must be a certain amount of your time that's just spent doing regular office stuff that we all do, right? Or maybe not.
No. I think a big I had to get on. I was encouraged to establish a Twitter presence a couple of years ago, and it's been the worst thing that has ever happened to me.
You could probably say that about Twitter itself. in some ways for all of us.
No, it's really awful. But so I would say a huge chunk of time might be to, procrastination, trying to get inspired to write something, get inspired to, return the 50 emails or, right. or phone calls that have piled up, writing budget reports or things like that. So there's plenty of just it's an office job, right? Yeah. So I guess that would be the if you want to know what it's like to be like, an attorney at, a national legal organization, I would say a huge percentage of the job is just, sitting at an office and typing on your computer or talking on the phone.
Yeah.
So we don't really get to, be out there that much unless we are actually, there, on the ground meeting with clients or taking depositions or being in court.
Yeah. So I do wonder, what's the office environment like at the ACLU though? Is it buzzing with energy of people doing this important work?
I'd say it depends. there has been known to be energetic buzzing.
Sure.
At times and especially, but again with that, it's often, this happened in the news. We got to get this thing filed within the next 24 hours. Or, can you believe, this decision that just came down and everyone reading it and trying to figure out what it means and reading out like the best parts of it to each other. So there's sort of those types of moments. But if it's a matter of, we're working on writing the perfect legal brief for such and such court of appeals. It's not that different. That part is not that different from a law firm or a government office. Writing is like a solitary exercise, and so there's a lot of sitting at desks.
Yeah. So as someone whose entire knowledge of the legal profession comes from probably John Grisham movies, not even the books probably. But as someone who, like me, is largely ignorant of the way that the law functions and the way that attorneys like you function, what does that process of writing a brief entail? It sounds like that would be an important part of what you do. What are you doing when you're writing a brief?
In many cases, we are working in areas where we are bringing similar cases in different courts, all on a particular issue. So, one of the big issues that we're fighting now, even increasingly now that we don't have to spend all our time, fighting the fifth marriage ban that, the state has enacted, is to make sure that things like Title VII, which is a statute that protects people from employment discrimination on the basis of sex, protects LGBT folks. And we keep track of all the cases on that. We've sort of written briefs on that subject many times by now. And so we're not really starting from scratch every time we, have a new case on that topic. A lot of the work is still not just updating the legal stuff, but you got to give life to it with your clients and the goal. A judge should want a rule for you, or the judge should think you're right. Just by reading the statement of facts before even getting to what the law is, like you should be able to tell a story about what happened and why it's wrong and why it's illegal before you even get to talking about the law. Or else you got to explain why it matters and explain why it's important that these legal principles are applied a particular way. And so that's different every time you do it, right? Your clients are different every time. And you know, and how you talk about stuff gets shaped by who you're representing and what they're experiencing.
So some of the job is storytelling in that sense.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I was an English major. I think there are plenty of English majors that end up being lawyers. And I mean, there's actually a whole big like field on like narratology and law and shaping legal stories. But I think it is true that you are trying to, you know, tie together this legal principle and this person's life. And it's a very exciting thing to do. And it's one of the, I think, going back to what we talked about, but like impact litigation, I think that's the model, right? And so you have to fit the two together.
Are you also thinking about your audience? I mean, do you write things with particular judges, particular courts in mind, thinking about how these specific individuals have responded to things in the past, how they might respond in the future?
Yeah, well, there's specific we should try to strategically bring cases in front of particular in jurisdictions to build the law a particular way. And obviously, you know, you're writing with knowing that the reader is going to be a judge and not yourself. But, you know, at the same time, and I think this is really, really important, is you also have an obligation to, at the same time, be true to the people whose stories you're telling. And I didn't feel this sort of moral sense of responsibility as acutely when I was doing stuff like recognition of relationships of LGBT folks, because, you know, being gay myself, I didn't feel as much of a gap between me or and the stories we were telling that sure, yeah. I felt, you know, I was obviously there's a gap between me and other people, but it sort of, I felt like a little more closely within the same community. Yeah. And when I'm doing cases on behalf of trans clients, which now the vast majority of my work right now is on that, I do constantly feel a sense of like moral and ethical responsibility to be telling their story on their terms, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you don't want to it's important that you don't feel like, oh, well, I'm not going to I'm worried about how a judge like would react to something, and so I'm like not gonna talk about it. I think there used to be a long time where people you know, sort of were nervous in how much. So, for example, I think a huge issue in so many cases is increasingly dispelling these, you know, myths about, you know, what biological sex is and what people's bodies look like and what happens in locker rooms when people get dressed and undressed. And I think that there's a time when people felt like, oh, we want to just like avoid talking about that because it will make the judges uncomfortable. And I think that I don't think that's a good strategy anymore. But I think even like more important, I think that you got to be really careful when you're trying to make a decision about how someone else's life is going to be represented and how someone else's story is told. And it's just so important that that the person in the driver's seat and is the client and the client's story, and that you are not trying to like impose a different story on the client's life. So I feel like I'm talking like in broad abstracts, but I think that on the issue of advocating for the rights of trans folks, there's a huge need for to have more trans attorneys in positions like mine, being able to tell these stories on behalf of other trans people. And I think I have to be aware of that I am telling someone else's story and not my own when I'm doing this.
There's a kind of foundational justice to that, to telling someone's story rightly and fully as you're trying to get justice for them, I assume.
Yeah, yeah. And well, it's funny. I used to – if you look at like briefs that were filed even, you know, 5 years ago, you see some briefs where, talking about, Mrs. X, Mrs. So-and-so, works somewhere, blah, blah, blah. And right away having a footnote over the pronoun, and saying something like, we refer to Mrs. X with female pronouns because that is her gender identity. Here are some other cases where courts refer to someone by the by the right pronouns, almost immediately explaining and apologizing for it. And I was working on a case where, that sort of template came up, and it just felt so jarring to see it there. It's like, we're way past that. The idea that you would have to sort of explain and clear your throat and apologize for just, describing someone as who they are. And it's amazing that we are objectively, past that. I don't think any judge, blinks an eye at that. Or if you have a judge that blinks an eye at that, you have bigger problems.
Sure.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Maybe we can actually get specific here. We talked about like how you would represent a case, but we haven't really talked about exactly about how a case lands on your desk in the first place. Can you tell us about something that you worked on that became really important to you, whether it's something you're on now or something you did recently, how it arrived in your professional world in the first place?
Yeah, sure. And so I have two examples that come to mind. And so I guess the first one I'll talk about, Gavin Grimm, so I'm the lead attorney on that case. Gavin is he's now 18, but at the time I met him, he was 15 years old, and he was still lives in Gloucester, Virginia, which is a Virginia area that's close to the shore. And so at the time he was a 15-year-old boy who is trans, and before I met him, there was local news coverage of him up in the middle of a school board meeting sort of defending his, right to be able to use the restroom. We first heard about it through, I think, his family reached out to us both at the Virginia affiliate and at the national office for help. We had
What were they looking for help with at that point?
So it was an interesting series of events. You know, what happened was he had been using the restroom. Some adults in the community complained, and then there were two school board meetings where basically, you know, he was the topic of discussion. And he showed up at the first school board meeting, said the most eloquent speech I've ever heard. And then a decision was postponed till the second school board meeting about a month later. So in between those two meetings is when he contacted us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then
is that typical that families or potential clients would reach out to the ACLU directly?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would say a huge, huge, huge percentage of cases we get are just through intakes of, you know, people who need help. Mm-hmm. And maybe they've heard of us through other cases. Maybe they've heard of us, you know, through, you know, legal brochures or Know Your Rights materials. Maybe someone said, oh, you should talk to the ACLU about this. But I would say that's a huge way that you know, we hear about cases is people coming to us for help. And so in Gavin's case, you know, this is an issue that I think we'd all been very focused on. We'd all been very focused on, you know, helping precedent continue to evolve. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like a bolt of lightning to have a situation where what happened, you know, to Gavin was so egregious in a way that was tailor-made for a legal case at the time. Mm. It was, for example, here are a couple reasons. First, he had been using the restroom for 7 weeks with nothing happening, and then they decided to kick him out. So, you know, with those cases, you had to a huge part of hurdle was sort of dispelling judges' fear that the sky would fall if you let boys who are transgender use the same restrooms as other boys. And here you had living proof. It had happened. There wasn't a problem. Mm-hmm. They passed a policy whose sole purpose was to kick him out of the bathroom. Can you imagine? You're a kid. And not only is this an issue where, you know, your administrators are hostile to you, but your entire school board decides to pass a policy solely because of you and in reaction to you using the bathroom. Yeah. And it was also a situation where the school board had stepped in and overruled its own principal and superintendent. So everyone on the ground didn't think this was necessary. And then you had the school board stepping in. I mean, those are amazing types of facts for starkly presenting an issue. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're hearing someone, if someone's describing, you know, a potential intake to you, you think, you know, oh, that's great. I mean, that's terrible. That's right. Really, really terrible. But, sure. You know, yeah. That's great for the case. But then from then on, you know, we sort of we talked with Gavin about what his options were, talk about all the various steps we think we would go through, where we expected the school would then sort of back down. And, you know, at each step of the way, I have to say I was really surprised at the intransigence of this particular school board. And I still am. We're still litigating against them. But I'm smiling right now because I was thinking about what I was saying a couple minutes ago about, oh, the narratology and storytelling. And I would say that 95, you know, percent of my emotions was just like sheer like rage at the way that he was being treated, and complete indignation at, you know, so indignation at what the school was doing, indignation about the legal arguments that it was making. And I, you know, on one hand, you know, we're separated from the community that we serve and that we're like in a office building, like writing legal briefs. On the other hand, we are like representing real people, and you sort of get, you know, every single thing that like happens to your client in the course of the case, you know, hit, you know, you feel it. You feel a fraction of it. You know, nothing like what the client does, but yeah, there's nothing sort of, you know, abstract about that at all. It's like, I can't believe the outrageous thing that they just wrote, and I can't wait to write a response showing, you know, how outrageous it is. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it's adrenaline, and
does that,
and that part's
of
fun,
like, of righteousness, maybe even of anger, affect what it is like to do this job on a day-to-day basis, or is that just like an occasional thing that comes and goes?
I think that it affects just being a lawyer.
Sure.
So I think that, you know, if you're just a lawyer in like civil discovery, like, you know, representing one like business against another, you're going to have close to that same level of, I think most of civil discovery is like lawyers writing nasty letters to each other and having like, you know, hostile phone calls, and like, it's a, you know, it's a, the whole system is adversarial, like that's the word for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and so I think that I you know, I knew that no matter what I did, I, you know, would end up feeling, you know, personally invested in it. And so I didn't want to feel personally invested in something that wasn't worth feeling personally invested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a huge thing that, you know, drove me to, you know, doing this type of work, where it's like, who cares how article like 3.4 of this, you know, contract of asset purchasing, you know, is interpreted.
Not me.
I mean,
maybe
if you were on the case, you'd be like, it is outrageous how they are saying that, you know, including, you know, is being interpreted that way, because there's no comma there. And, you know, like you would get in the weeds of it still. But it is, you know, it's not, you know, worth, you know, giving your, you know, your life and energy,
at least,
you know,
not to
that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that it seems like, especially with regard to the Gavin Grimm case, that's interesting is that it's not like you're just suddenly stepping in to defend something before the Supreme Court. I mean, you were seeing this young man through a variety of stages of the legal process that shaped his case, right?
Yeah, I mean, got to see him. I mean, I did get to see him, you know, grow up, or like turn from a teenage boy to a young man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I am every day just in complete awe of him. I was in complete awe of him as a 15-year-old, and I just, every time I'm with him, I'm just amazed. And I don't know how I got so lucky. I don't know how, you know, we all got so lucky, that he is who he is.
Yeah.
And it's been amazing to see him grow, and, you know, and it's been an emotional roller coaster, right? You lose it. You know, we lost at the district court. You win at the Court of Appeals. You know, then, you know, the Supreme Court comes in and like issues an emergency stay over the summer, and where again, to have the Supreme Court issue an emergency order to stop you from using the bathroom is just, I really will never get over that.
Yeah.
What happened, and, you know, and then, you know, the case is at the Supreme Court, and I, you know, my shortly after the Supreme Court took the case, the election in 2016 happened, and to everyone I saw, I was like, you know, we might all be blown up, you know, within the next 4 years, but God damn it, I want Gavin to be able to use the boys' restroom, you know, before we're all blown up. And, And, you know, and I really, it kills me. It kills me that, you know, even once we're going to win it, we are going to win the case. And it just kills me that they were able to keep him out of the, you know, the restroom, mm-hmm. Up through his graduation.
Yeah.
It really, I still can't get over that. And, you know, and this is, by the time Gavin was a senior, you know, he had a birth certificate reflecting that he's male. You know, if you look at the I'm sure people remember the North Carolina HB2 law that was so terrible and still lives on in a different form. But that was a law that required people to use restrooms that matched their birth certificates. Right. So this is, they went even beyond that. And they were, so there was no reason for it except, stubbornness in cruelty. And I can't get over it. So I it'll be, we'll have vindication after the fact, but it's still amazing to think back on.
What's the best way to learn a language? Immersion, living where the language is spoken and using it every day in everyday situations. But if that's not on the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. I've used apps in the past to learn new languages, but when I came across Babbel, I wondered if it could help me refresh my knowledge of a language I once spoke well, but was now a little bit or quite a lot rusty. I have to say, I was impressed. The advanced lessons were really useful, tips and idioms that can help with in-depth conversations on topics that I can actually imagine chatting about. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations, and the tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. What's more, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for working listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for working listeners, at babbel.com/working. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/working, spelled BABBEL.com/working. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Well, let's talk about, you know, an important part of that long process that you've been involved in there, which is the time that you spend in court or possibly the time you spend preparing for court. I mean, how much of that, whether it's the Gavin Grimm case or others that you're working on, how much of your time is involved in actual court-related activities?
A really small amount. So when you talk about court-related activities, there are different types. So there's arguing motions where you're up in front of the judge saying what the law is. And, you know, that is – some people really dislike that. I really, you know, like it when it's – especially when it's, you know, not a motion about, you know, whether some piece of evidence comes in, but just, you know, the motion on – it's called a dispositive motion, like – is this a valid legal claim or not? Mm-hmm. You know, does this person win or not? What's the appeal? And that's, you know, you're just having a conversation with the judge about, you know, the case and the law. And, you know, there's a ton of adrenaline there. You lose sleep beforehand. You spend a week beforehand, you know, being like you used to stand out as someone on the street just muttering to yourself. Like, that used to be you know, conspicuous. I mean, now they think you're just that you're just talking on a Bluetooth headset. But you know,
you're rehearsing to yourself. You're practicing.
Yes,
what you're going to argue and how you're going to argue it.
Yeah. Right. And so, at least you know, for me, you know, talking to yourself in the shower all the time, thinking, "Oh, I would phrase it this way. I'll do this." And so that is a lot of like mental buildup. And then you're there, and you have the argument, and you know, it either went terribly or it went great. And then there's a big, you know, adrenaline drop after that. that's like a that's a really small fraction of the, you know, what you get to do. There's also depositions, which is where you are, you're not in court, but you are in like an office conference room across the table from a witness, mm-hmm. and you are asking questions and the witness is answering, and there's someone at the edge of the table typing down, you know, everything that you're saying. And, you know, that's interesting. That's very interesting too. And it's often actually a time where, you know, you are, you know, across the table from the person you're suing. You're across the table from the person that, you know, fired your client or said that, you know, they couldn't cancel their wedding reception after they found out that that your clients were gay. And, you know, you're there. You're asking questions to the witness on the other side, and they're answering it. And I mean, that also is very interesting, especially because, you know, your job, you know, people always say that your job as a witness at a deposition isn't to, you know, volunteer information. So, you know, if someone asks you, do you know what time it is? You say, yes. Right. And you don't go one step more and say it's 2:25. It's an interesting process, and you're finding out information for the first time. So that's all very interesting and tiring. I'd say, like, you know, all that is maybe about on a typical year. I would say that is maybe 15 to 20% of what you're doing. Hmm. And that, you know, there could be a year where you're just like on a case that has a ton of depositions, and that's just, you know, where you spend most of your, you know, like a couple months. But I would say that's more rare, and in part because, you know, we are trying to pick cases where there aren't really a lot of factual disputes, right? Because if it's a factual dispute, then the case can just sort of go away on, you know, did this person really fire someone because he was gay, or did they fire this person because of, you know, all these other things in their employment, you know, record? And that's the question.
You're looking for a boss who says, hell yeah, I fired him because he was gay, so that you can test whether that itself is okay. For example, I mean,
yeah,
it's hypothetical.
Yeah, and we have the fortune or misfortune of still living in a time where people say that.
Sure.
Right. And
I would say misfortune, but I'm glad
that's so terrible. You know, yeah. Again, that's great. That's terrible.
Right.
But it is actually like a difference in terms of, well, I don't know. I have a spiel. I have like a little, like, you know, speech about this where, as a formal matter, equality for LGBT folks, you know, is so far behind that all the allegedly, like, you know, great rulings are really just like trying to catch, you know, LGBT folks up to getting the same formal equality as other people, and then you know, we'll end up being in the same trenches as everyone else and fighting like entrenched, institutionalized, like, patterns of discrimination that are less visible. Mm. I sort of I feel like, you know, since the summer of 2016, the idea that that there are all sorts of discrimination that, you know, I think I once thought you had to, you know, do more work to unearth, in that people were at least self-conscious enough to not be as explicit about it. You know, I thought we were at a place where, you know, openly, you know, racist and anti-Semitic and misogynistic things were not said, you know, not just by, you know, the president, but also, you know, by, all other private and public actors. And I think we're not quite as far along in that as I would have hoped.
Yeah,
but
it's a despairing moment in that way. But probably an exciting one for people doing work of the kind that you are, in that it's a moment when it's clear what a difference we have to make.
Yeah. No, I'm depressed about it. but we still tend to get more cases where someone's like, I you know, you're fired because you're gay, yeah. Or I'm not going to give you a cake. I'm not going to like bake the same cake for you that I bake for everyone else because, you know, you're gay, or I am not going to, I'm not going to, give your spouse, health insurance because, that would force me to recognize the legitimacy of your marriage, or I have a religious objection to the simple fact that you exist as a transgender person and me, you know, having to interact with you without telling you that you are, contrary to what I think God's vision should be, is a burden on my religious beliefs that you shouldn't exist. So those are fact patterns that we get. And it doesn't, we're still a long way until we, people have to cloak that.
You talked
more
about,
subtly.
You talked about drawing on that outrage, anger, that frustration, but you also say that it's a depressing moment. That makes sense. I mean, does it? It must be tough sometimes in your job to just deal with face the specificity, the baldness of bigotry so often.
It is, and it's you don't get to sort of tune. You know, this is the side effect of having working on issues you care about, is that there isn't a separation between, you know, work and the rest of life. So you can't just tune out the news.
Yeah.
And you know, whatever Jeff's terrible thing Jeff Sessions has done, you know, if it doesn't directly impact your work, it like directly impacts like the work of your friend right down the hall. And so there's just sort of a, you sort of can't escape all the bad things that the administration is doing on a variety of fronts, whether it's in, like, holding undocumented teenage girls, you know, prisoner so they can't have an abortion, you know, or whether it's, you know, rounding up and people who have been living in this country for decades. So that's hard. And I think that we have the legal rights for LGBT folks have, you know, had several low points. But you know, the broad arc over the past 20 years has been like optimism with Justice Kennedy providing a fifth vote for a Supreme Court majority, and a feeling that the future will be better, not worse, in terms of where the law is going. And that hasn't been the case for, you know, colleagues I'm working on other issues. I think that sort of living with what colleagues in the Reproductive Freedom Project have been living with, you know, for decades and decades of, you know, feeling just, you know, every day is just trying to fighting a rear guard action. But, you know, for the first time, we're sort of looking at another, you know, 5 or 10 years where the, you know, the outlook of like where the Supreme Court will be, at least, is likely to get worse with time, not better with time. Mm-hmm. And that's just a reality to that we're all adjusting to.
Can we talk a little about the Supreme Court? You've argued cases before the Supreme Court, yeah?
No. So I haven't. I feel okay. Like I did with Gavin's.
Yeah. Sure.
So Gavin's. So I've been on many the team writing the legal briefs on many cases, and like, you know, helping prepare moots. Which is a really exciting experience. Mm-hmm. But you know, I haven't been the person up there.
Sure.
Although it's funny, like I sort of feel like going through the process of trying to get ready, in Gavin's case, makes, oh, I almost feel like I, part of me feels like, I've no big deal. I've already done it, even though like I haven't actually. Yeah. But so that's a case where we were up at the Supreme Court, but the lower court had ruled for us, saying that we were right, Gavin's rights were violated because of a guidance document that the Obama administration had issued that the court was deferring to as a reasonable interpretation of the law. And a few weeks before argument was supposed to happen, the government rescinded that guidance document. And their news report saying that it was a guidance document from the Department of Education, which is run by Betsy DeVos, but that Jeff Sessions, his first act was to force her to rescind the document. And she didn't want to, which is amazing. But
surprising
it went all the way up.
Perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, well, when you are in a bad place when Betsy DeVos is the person in the conversation that is, ostensibly protecting, your civil rights. That's not a good terrain to be fighting on. But it apparently, according to the news reports, went up to Trump, and Trump said, do what Jeff Sessions wants you to do, or resign. And so by pulling that document, it kicked the case out of the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court then sent the case back down to the lower courts, saying, "Okay, now that that document isn't there, decide who's right without relying on that document." So it's not a loss. It's just sort of kicks the legs out from under the procedural posture that got us up there, and so now we're, back in the lower courts.
Yeah, but so that's an ongoing case. But in others that you've been involved with, even if you didn't argue before the Supreme Court, you've been responsible for or connected with some cases that led to huge historical decisions in the United States. I'm thinking especially of Obergefell. What does that feel like to be part of the team that is making that kind of difference?
It feels feels good. I mean, it feels good and it feels terrible because you feel like you feel like there's a connection between what you are doing and what the ultimate outcome might be, right? Oh, if we use this word instead of that word, that might be what makes the paragraph just persuasive enough to, have five Supreme Court justices rule in your favor. And so there's a feeling of like efficacy and that you are, useful. But at the same time, there's a feeling of it can be relaxing to feel like, oh, I am not personally involved in what's going to happen. Like my choice about whether there's a comma here or a comma there, like won't have any, effect on, whether there'll be marriage equality for the entire country or not.
Sure.
So I'm thinking the most recent Supreme Court case like our project has been Masterpiece Cake Shop, which is, the baker that wouldn't bake the same cake he would bake for anyone else just because it was a same-sex couple that was getting married. And that's an issue I've worked on similar type cases, and it's an issue I care about to a huge degree, but I wasn't on the legal team at the Supreme Court on this case. And I have to say, it was much more enjoyable than actually being on the team, just because it feels like everything is heightened. Your sense of responsibility is heightened. Your sense of anxiety is heightened. And, everything's turned up to 11, and the good and the bad.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This was fascinating. I learned so much.
Thanks. I had a great time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. This week, we also want to recommend that you check out another Slate show, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast. On that show, Gabriel Roth, Rebecca Lavoie, and Carvel Wallace discuss all aspects of parenting, from toddlers to teens to step-parenting to race relations and housing. They're not parenting experts. They're just parents figuring it out as they go in public and on a weekly show. You'll learn things about what's under Rebecca's teenage son's bed, how many times you should be required to go to your child's production of Bye Bye Birdie, and more. They answer listener questions, share their own parenting triumphs and fails, and talk through parenting issues in the news. So keep an eye out at slate.com/momanddad, or subscribe to Mom and Dad Are Fighting wherever you get your podcasts. Here at Working, we always welcome your thoughts about Working. You can email us via working@slate.com. You can listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. We want to give a huge shout out for this season to a ton of folks at Slate, too many to even name, but who helped us track down guests and think about how to shape what you've been listening to for the last eight episodes, if you've been listening to the last eight episodes, which we hope you will. I also want to thank Jacob Liebenloft, who suggested that we get in touch with Josh Block at the ACLU. This episode was produced and edited by Benjamin Frisch.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.